Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's Author on Tour features three of our nation's leading political thinkers, former Colorado Senator Gary Hart, former Senator and presidential candidate George McGovern, and former Colorado Governor Richard Lamb. Each has written a book for Fulcrum Publishing's provocative Speaker's Corner series on pressing issues of our generation, religion and politics, Social Security and health care. In the weeks to come, we have Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, Allegra Goodman, John Grogan, Rita Mae Brown, Francis Mays, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Well, thank you all for coming this evening, and I'm very sorry that we don't have chairs for everyone, but we have the floor if you're comfortable sitting on the floor, and I'm sorry you have to stand. We're trying to get a few more chairs. I heard, but I didn't hear it actually because I was avoiding listening to anything because I was afraid I'd get into the pregame information. But I hear you were on Wait, Don't Tell Me. And did very well and won for his partner, Carl Castle, giving the message on their answering machine. So,
because I know more about Jack Abramoff.
More than you should know, I guess. Well, it is always a pleasure to welcome Senator Gary Hart to the Tattered Cover, as it means he has written another thought-provoking book. This evening, he is here to introduce two books, God and Caesar in America, an essay on religion and politics, and The Shield and the Cloak, The Security of the Commons. The first book is centered around the religious revival in the United States, particularly as it affects public policy. The second is about the growing threat of terrorism and how a great democracy deals with it. Both, as Senator Hart points out, have their roots in the end of the Cold War, and both are of great concern to policymakers and citizens who are affected by their decisions. As in his previous books dealing with political issues, he is clear in his intent, and his writing is suitable both for the citizen looking for answers to questions of current public policy and also for those who implement those policies. He brings a rich background to his discourse. Having been raised in the Church of the Nazarene and graduated from Bethany Nazarene College as well as a Yale Divinity School. In addition, he holds a law degree from Yale and recently gained a doctorate degree from Oxford. He represented Colorado in the United States Senate from 1975 until 1987 and was a candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination for president. He warned of a 9/11 type attack in his role as co-chair of the U.S. Commission on National Security 21st Century and continues to speak out on issues that our country faces. Please join me in welcoming Senator Gary Hart.
Thank you, as always.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I am once again deeply indebted to one of the greatest bookstores in America, Tattered Cover. We all here and thousands of others beyond this room have to find East Colfax between now and June. And I hope you have a great parking lot there. I don't think I hold the record for most appearances at Tattered Cover, but I've been here an awful lot. This is, surprisingly to me, one of the largest crowds that we've had, and I can't quite account for it. Somebody who I won't attribute this to says the worse things get, the more people want to hear you talk. I have with me anonymously my wife of many years, but she made me promise not to introduce her, so I won't. But if you see a very attractive, youngish-looking lady, that's my wife. Publishers usually promote authors, but I'm here to promote at least one publisher, and that's Fulcrum Books. And until 3 or 4 years ago, I didn't know about Fulcrum, but Bob Barron and Sam Shinta and the fabulous staff publish books in Golden, Colorado, and I would encourage you to get to know Fulcrum online or any other place. As media and publishing and information is concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, it seems to me even more important that small publishers, less well-known publishers, are paid attention to and their books are bought. And Fulcrum has published some fabulous books on the environment, nature, Colorado. But about a year or a year and a half ago, Fulcrum began to restore a publishing form that had fallen away. I'm told by former editors of mine that in the Depression era, it was commonplace for publishers to publish essays in what were called blue book forms. And since no one had any money, people paid 10 cents or 25 cents. And I don't know who the authors were. I suppose in those days, H.L. Mencken or whomever. But people pored over these things. They read them on buses and subways and so on. And Fulcrum, brilliantly, I think, has restored the essay format. And they have given me a chance to publish my essay, which I'll discuss. But also Dick Lamb, very provocative local author, and as you know, full of a lot of ideas. George McGovern on Social Security. Arnie Grossman, a friend of mine, has written on gun control, and that will be out presently. And guess what? You can put them in your pocket. Now, I travel a lot. I'm on airplanes. I read on airplanes. And I guess many of you do, or any mode of public transportation. And with all due respect to Tattered Cover, I mean, I got to a point, perhaps it's my age, where bringing an 800-page book or novel on board, I sometimes say 800-pound, I don't mean that, but 800-page, and lugging that around in your luggage isn't much fun. Now, I can almost guarantee you at 86 pages, you can read this between here and Washington or New York for sure, maybe 2 trips to Los Angeles, I don't know, or just riding on the bus. Anyway, it's a great idea, and I thank Bob Barron and Sam Shinta and their colleagues for bringing this format back. Now, let me talk about this book, and they have gallantly permitted me to also promote another book. This is kind of an embarrassment for riches. I know my many critics are saying, why don't you just sit down and shut up? I found it impossible, and in fact, in a kind of... mad, crazed era of productivity, published 4 or 5 books in the last 18 months, and I can't account for it. It was just, maybe it's a last gasp, I don't know. But I did a book for Arthur Schlesinger on the presidency of James Monroe. I did a book called The Fourth Power late last year, on a new, what I call a new grand strategy for the United States. I think that's still on the shelves here. For Oxford Press as this one. And then Fulcrum asked me to do this book, and I was happy to do it. And it really just came right out. I mean, I wrote this so fast you wouldn't believe it, but it was all there. And then I wrote a book, I wrote this one on a sabbatical at Oxford on a new security policy for America, new security philosophy, actually. I will talk briefly about that. And then I have one coming out later this year, called Courage of Our Convictions. And the first third of it, I take my party, Democratic Party's leaders, to task and lash them severely for lacking both courage and conviction, and then try to offer at the end of it, the last half or two-thirds, some ideas based in the Democratic Party's past as to how we can restore ourselves to some stature of leadership. God and Caesar in America, of course, the title comes from the famous, I don't think you say famous with regard to Jesus, well-known, the famous author Jesus. The well-known quote, Jesus was, in his gospel and his preachings, was always being tried to be trapped, not by the Romans, but by the religious leaders of the day. And they would put people in the audience. I've never heard this happen before, but plant questions. And one of the questioners said to Jesus, "Your gospel is about eternal life, so you don't believe in obeying the law or paying due respect to Caesar." Jesus said, I almost said brilliantly, but that's again kind of redundant, isn't it? Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and render unto God that which is God's." And so that is where the title comes from. Now, I've always, in appearances like this, found it, not sure what, arrogant or something to read one's own words. But I write better than I talk, so you will forgive me if I do that. Let me just run through the content so you'll get a sense of what I'm trying to do here in this 86 pages. First of all, I discuss the fact that there is, in fact, a religious revival in America, and that's not new. Again, if you're a disciple of or a student of Schlesinger's, you know he believes in cycles of American history, and in fact, there have been cycles of religious revivals in America. Jonathan Edwards, pre-Constitution, 16, somebody correct me, 30, 40, the Great Awakening, which was a restoration of spiritual values in America, particularly Christian spiritual values. So religious revivals aren't new. We went in the late 19th, early 20th century, Billy Sunday, and of course beyond him, Billy Graham. It's not well known, but one of my spiritual instructors was John Wesley. I'll get into that a bit. John Wesley came to the United States. He was a great social and religious reformer in England, as you know, in the 18th century. He came to the United States and preached against slavery. Not well known. I'll come around to John Wesley. So we have these revivals. What I say in this essay is the revival today is different. It's different in two respects. It isn't across the religious spectrum. It's not even across the Christian spectrum. It is one wing of one element of Christianity, namely Protestantism. And that is a conservative wing that is part evangelical, part fundamentalist. Now, as Margaret said, my wife and I grew up in the Church of the Nazarene. Now, give you a sense of the Nazarenes. They broke away 100 years ago from the Methodists because they said the Methodists were too liberal. You get the picture. Nazarenes were more evangelical than fundamentalists. I think the southern elements of the church did believe Jonah was literally swallowed by a whale, God created the heavens and earth in 6 days, rested on the seventh, so on. But they were more interested in saving souls, which means they were more evangelical. And there is a difference, and it's important to keep that separate. Not all fundamentalists are evangelical, not all evangelicals are fundamentalists. But anyway, the point is, this is one wing of Protestantism. So it is not an encompassing religious revival that sweeps up all of our society. It is a separate element. The second thing that's distinct about it, and what raises the issue here, is it has become more political than any religious revival in American history. If anybody here can contradict me historically, I'm happy to hear your thoughts. But I think what is happening in the last 15, 20 years is distinct from all other religious revivals, because the conservative elements of this revival have inserted themselves into one political party, namely the Republican Party. And so I then qualify myself to write this essay, basically giving my religious background. And as I've said before, if the Nazarene Church was here, the Yale Divinity School was here. Evangelical Protestant, Congregationalist, traditional, very social, gospel-minded. So I kind of worked that across the spectrum. But I qualify myself by giving this background. Now, those of us like me who are, Mr. Lumbaugh would say, liberals, have been quiet about this issue. And it's strange to me because, as you know, I ran for the Senate here in 74, reelected in 80, ran for president in 84, and almost no one ever said, what's your religion? What's your spirituality? That was just 15, 20 years ago, 20 years ago. Time flies. Now, if you run for office, almost automatically you have to stand up in a state like this and other states and say, I'm a this and or I'm a that or I'm a man of values and faith and so on. So it's just the whole thing is kind of tipped on its head. And so I make that point and talk about, and so qualify myself to write this by saying, here's what my background is. And by the way, the Nazarenes were evangelical. They had a lot of rules. No drinking, no smoking, no dancing, no adornment of women, makeup, jewelry, and so on, no card playing, no movie going, and so on. I probably missed a lot. And the story was told at Bethany Nazarene College, where Lee and I went. The dean of students, and this part is true, went around the campus on Saturday nights and tried to find students doing bad things. Now, we were all told to tell the truth, and it turned out that one Saturday night, the dean goes into the darkened gymnasium and shines his light around and finds in the far corner young man and young woman very close together. Dean says, what are you doing down there? The boy is told not to lie. So he says, Dean, we're making love. Dean says, that's all right. I thought you were dancing. Then I get into faith and what. There's all this vague language about faith and values. And what I argue here is state what faith you're talking about and what values you're talking about. Don't just talk faith and values. What faith, what values? Because what I think is going on here politically is people are using those code words to suggest to all of us that if you have faith and values, you are going to join up with them because they are the party of faith and values. And the other side doesn't have faith and values. But among themselves, what they mean is anti-choice, anti-gun control, pro-death penalty, a very narrow social agenda. So they're having it both ways. People at large think, well, yeah, I've got faith and values, so maybe I should be with them. But what they mean is something very, very different. So I challenge the religious right to say, spell out your faith. Which faith? Are you including Jewish Americans or not? Do you include Catholics or not? Do you include Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, and the rest? What faith? And what values are you talking about? I'll get to that momentarily. I talk about the tyranny of the faithful and the dangers of theocracy. Now, the founders passed the First Amendment, separating church and state, because they came out of a European heritage where the church and the state were merged. Now, it was years before most of them, and before they came to America, but they had that history in mind. And the history was kings selected popes, popes selected kings, and the church and the state were merged. And they shared power, and it was not only undemocratic, it was a theocracy. A theocracy is where religious institutions dominate the state and the government. And there's a danger there. And that's why the founders said, I mean, Jefferson, who was a deist, talked about divine providence. Everybody, most of those people, had some notion of God and some religious conviction. In some cases, very deep and very broad. But they didn't believe they ought to impose it on the rest of the country. That was the difference. Now, today, you have people with deep convictions who think they ought to impose those convictions on all the rest of us by law and by selection of candidates for office, selection of judges, and the rest of it. That is theocracy. It is very dangerous. And the next step, if you want to do that, is, well, if we're going to do it in America, and America is going to run the world, let's impose our faith and values on everybody else. So that makes America the avenging angel. Now, that is not a role that the founders of this country ever envisioned. America as avenging angel. And there are a lot of Arab people, Muslim, Islamic people, from Gibraltar to the east of Indonesia, about 1.2 billion, who think we're not only there to bring democracy at the point of a bayonet, but we are also there to bring capitalism, and we are there to bring Christianity. Now, that is the source of an awful lot of the insurgency in Iraq and elsewhere. And the president once used the word crusade until somebody got a hold of him and said, not a good word. People there remember 1,000 years ago when the Christians came and slaughtered them. And they think maybe that's what you're up to here. So the president never used that word again. All right, now, then I end up talking about the gospel of Jesus. Now, here's where I find a real conflict, because I was raised in that tradition, and I read the gospels, and I was in a way transformed by them. And oddly enough, that's why I became a liberal Democrat. Read the Sermon on the Mount. Who did Jesus bless? Those who mourn. Those who mourn. Those who are poor in spirit. Those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. Not those who claim righteousness. Those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. The peacemakers. Not the warriors. The peacemakers. Now, I dare anyone in this audience or beyond to read the Sermon on the Mount and relate that to what the religious right in America today is preaching. They are not preaching compassion. They are not preaching tolerance. They are not preaching non-judgmentalism, which was central to the Jesus gospel. Judge not, that ye be not judged. Let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Are you hearing that from Dr. Dobson or any of these other guys? Not a word. Nor from Lumbaugh or any of the rest of them. What they are preaching is not the gospel of Jesus. So whatever their faith and values are, they are not the values of Jesus. What I say here is that, better read it than quote myself. The quarrel of the early 21st century American religious political right is not, as it argues, with liberalism. Its quarrel is with the Enlightenment. By the way, I would like each of you to go home tonight, pick up your dictionary, or go upstairs and get better yet, and buy a dictionary. Turn to L and look up liberalism. It doesn't say big government, a lot of regulations, high taxation, Mr. Lumbaugh's definition. It says tolerance, open-mindedness, inquisitiveness, and the list goes on. Now, no wonder he is against liberalism, because he's none of those things. He's intolerant, judgmental, and so on. Okay. For it was the English and Scottish Enlightenment that liberated America's founders to hold to traditional, though largely Protestant, Christianity, and, at the same time, pursue the ideal of knowledge, critical learning, the analytic method, science and scientific investigation, and, in Jefferson's phrase, the progress of the human mind. The Enlightenment did that. The Enlightenment, above all else, liberated human learning, and with the Reformation that preceded it, liberated politics and political systems from the confines of the medieval church, priestly control of knowledge, mythology and mystery, and religious cultism. The key to the survival of democracy for Jefferson was not the influence of the church, but the liberation of the human mind by broad-based public, not parochial, education. I talk about the culture of life, which is a big issue, as you know, with Terry Schiavo and all the rest of it. Culture of life. The religious right believes in the culture of life. A culture, quote, culture of life as applied to preservation of a fetus or brain-dead patient fails both as a moral standard and a political objective when it is not also applied to prisoners on death row and to civilian casualties in mistaken invasions. Faith-based initiatives in a thousand point of light fail as public policy when they are demonstrably insufficient to remedy the plight of 1 in 5 American children in poverty and millions of homeless and unemployed people. This is even more true when public money is sought for religious organizations, probably in violation of the Constitution of the United States, while public funds for public programs designed to help those children and those families are being denied. Tax cuts for the wealthy and powerful, especially in the face of deficits left as legacies to future generations, are not part of any faith that can be reconciled with Jesus' admonition that it would be harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. Now, I'm not against rich people, but the Gospels say a rich young man came to Jesus and said, "What must I do to enter the kingdom of heaven?" Jesus did not say, "Lobby your senator for a tax cut." He said, "Sell all that thou hast and give to the poor." Do you hear Dr. Dobson saying that? Or anybody in the faith and values crowd in Washington saying that? Not on your life. Well, hypocrisy often comes with religious revivals. And hypocrisy is simply defined as a gap between what you claim for yourself or your nation and what you actually do. Now, Americans set high standards for ourselves, as we should, and for our country. That's up here. But when we don't meet those standards, when we don't behave the way we preach, everybody in the world knows it. There is a kind of national mythology that we can kind of get by with stuff here, and Egyptians and Pakistanis and Japanese and Russians aren't going to know it. Everybody in the world knows what goes on in America. So don't think tonight that we can get by with hypocrisy, claiming one thing and doing another. But that's exactly what's happening. Culture of life. We've got people from the administration going around preaching the culture of life. We deny birth control education or information to poor women in the third world because the culture of life, people don't believe in it. Well, would you be surprised to know in 2004, four countries in the world carried out more than 90% of all the public executions or state-sponsored executions in the world. Guess what countries they were? North Korea, Iran, China, and the United States of America. Does it make you proud? Sound like the culture of life to you? Two of those countries are on the axis of evil. And we're trying to, a lot of people in Washington are trying to figure out how we can make the Chinese the next Soviet Union. We're hand in glove with them in the area of public execution of criminals. Shame on us. Shame on us. Well, hypocrisy. It's so tempting to read this whole book to you tonight. It's so good. I mean, America as Avenging Angel is not an America I can recognize, nor is it an America any of our founders could recognize. We may debate, and should, the degree to which religious belief should shape the laws and government of the United States, but there should be no debate in favor of the proposition that America has been divinely selected to govern the world according to the religious predispositions of a minority of our citizens. Well, it's just so much to talk about. Let me end up this part of my first speech. I quote Micah, the Old Testament prophet, end of the Old Testament era, Micah 6:8. People say, what really should we do? I think Micah hit it right on the head and predisposed people to think about Jesus. What does the Lord require of thee but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God? Justice, mercy, and humility. These are indeed values by which to live. They are even better values by which to govern. Justice, mercy, and humility. I don't find much of it in our present government. Let me end with this. Benjamin Disraeli, British Prime Minister in the mid-19th century, who knew a thing or two about religion and politics being a Jew, summarized his views in a fictional dialogue. He wrote a novel. Can't imagine politicians writing novels. He has his character say, sensible men are all of the same religion. And pray, what is that? Sensible men never tell. I talk about, end up by talking about the privileges I've had, and they're just extraordinary. But my greatest privilege is that I'm an American. That means that no man or woman can tell me what to believe. No minister, priest, or rabbi can dictate my political principles. No religious figure or organization can claim control of my government. No sect or church can replace the constitutional democracy that countless American patriots have given their lives to protect and preserve. I do believe that America still has a destiny. Whether that destiny is divinely dictated, neither I nor anyone else can ever know or ever say. I do believe that America's unrealized destiny has to do with achieving social justice in our own society, leading the world through a time of great revolution, setting higher standards for the protection of our earth, raising the standards of human rights for all, and calling forth the better angels of our nature. God's work is never done, and as John Kennedy said, here on earth, God's work must be our own. In the words of our republic's greatest hymn, our God is marching on, and so is the United States of America. Thank you very much. Now, briefly, throughout my life as a child of the Cold War, all I heard was national security. Our central organizing principle from 47 to 91 was containment of communism. We spent trillions of dollars hundreds of thousands of American lives and all of our foreign policy efforts in that effort. It came to a dramatic conclusion in the fall of 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. 10 years passed when we had nothing to replace containment of communism as a central organizing principle. And I think it was because neither party nor any of our leaders had a notion of what the world of the 21st century looked like. And we drifted in the 21st century with this sense of there's got to be an enemy out there someplace. And the commission on which I served for 2.5 years, between 1998 and 2001, said that the next real threat to the United States wasn't China or anyone else, it was terrorism, and we ought to get ready. The president didn't pay attention, the administration didn't pay attention. 8 months later, 3,000 Americans lost their lives. And by the way, we had said as early as 99, terrorists will attack the United States. There will be terrorist attacks on the United States, and Americans will die on American soil, possibly in large numbers. And we called on the president in January of 2001 to create a federal agency to stop terrorists at our borders and to be prepared for attack if it came. No one paid any attention. Part of the reason was they were so already focused on Saddam Hussein, pre-9/11. What this book seeks to do is to lay out a kind of new understanding of what security means. For 47 to 91. Security meant preventing Russians from launching missiles at us and vice versa. That's what security meant. National security. It's all anybody talked about. Russians, us, missiles, so on. Now we're in a new age of globalization, the information revolution, a lot of other things. So we've got to rethink what security means. And what I try to do here is suggest two things. Security of the 21st century has to include these elements. Not only security of our borders, prevention of terrorist attacks, security of the environment, security of energy, security of our communities, and a wide variety of other kinds of security of livelihood. For example, let's say you've just lost your job and you can't feed your family. You're feeling insecure. Let's say you just come from the doctors and the doctor said your kids have asthma because you're living near a polluting coal plant. You're not feeling very secure. Let's say the principal employer in your community picks up and goes to Bangladesh and 5,000 jobs are lost. You're not feeling very secure. You see where I'm headed. Let's say your child, your son, has just signed up for the Marines or Army so he can go to Gulf War IV and get oil supplies so your neighbor can drive his Humvee. You're probably not feeling very secure. So all I'm trying to do is get people to begin to think about what security means, because this administration is harping on security, and they're making it a one-note theme, prevention of terrorism. We're fighting them over there so they don't come here. Total nonsense. Total nonsense. I would say it if it were a Democratic administration. It's total nonsense. They are coming here. We're training them in Iraq. We're training them in Iraq. But it's all one note. President finally discovered that we're dependent, guess what, on foreign oil. Gee whiz. I campaigned for the Senate in this state in 1974 on the issue of energy dependence on foreign supplies, 30 years ago. Well, Mr. President, thank you very much. You've been president for 5 years, and you finally found out that we are so dependent on foreign oil supplies that it tilts our economy and so on and so forth. So that's point number one, a bigger, broader definition of security. Point number two, I think the idea of national security is fading away. By that I mean we need European and Asian intelligence, assets, special forces, cooperation, not more going it alone, which is what we did in Iraq, but more international cooperation. Listen, it was international alliances that permitted us to win two world wars and the Cold War. We didn't do that by ourselves. We did it with NATO, we did it with the Atlantic Alliance, we did it with partnerships all over the world, and we've almost totally severed those alliances. That's folly, because the world is going like this. We're going like this when the world is going like this. Globalization, information, changing nature of warfare. We need our allies. So that's point number two in this book. Thank you all. I am so happy to be one of the last speakers at this great, great, great bookstore, and I'm totally gratified at your presence. Thank you all very much.
Well, thank you all for coming this evening, and this is the second in the Speaker's Corner books we've done. Dick Lamb will be here in another week to do his book. But tonight we have with us Senator George McGovern, and I'd like to say welcome back. Senator McGovern has had a long and distinguished life, serving his country in a number of ways. Born and raised in South Dakota, as a youth he experienced the Great Depression. And then, as were many of his contemporaries, he was called to service in the military and served as a combat bomber pilot. And you can read more about this in Stephen Ambrose's book, The Wild Blue, which centers around Senator McGovern's service in World War II. He flew 35 missions and received the Distinguished Flying Cross. Returning to civilian life, he took advantage of the GI Bill and attended Northwestern University, where he received a PhD in history. After teaching a few years, he entered politics in South Dakota, ultimately representing that state in the House of Representatives, and then for 18 years as a United States Senator. He received his party's nomination for president, but was defeated by Richard Nixon. No comment. Since then, he has continued to serve his country, first as president of the Middle East Policy Council in Washington, and for 4 years as ambassador in Rome to the UN agencies on food and agriculture. He certainly exemplifies those honored by another South Dakotan, Tom Brokaw, as the greatest generation. Senator McGovern has written and lectured widely on issues that concern our nation and the world, most notably those affecting world hunger. Now he turns his attention to Social Security, an issue that has certainly drawn a great deal of attention from the present administration and citizens who are concerned about the future of benefits and whether this social insurance will be there for them when they reach retirement age. Social Security and the Golden Age, which he has written for the Fulcrum Publishers Speaker's Corner books, is a thoughtful and intriguing look at the future of this program and the consequences of our government's handling of it. Please join me in welcoming George McGovern.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for coming out tonight. This bookstore, as many of you know, has a reputation all over the country as a favorite stopping place for authors who are pressing a new book. I think the last time I was here, I greeted the audience and I spoke about the important role this bookstore has played. So I said it's a real honor to be here at the covered tatter. I couldn't understand why that provoked laughter in the audience, but you get wiser with the passing of the years, so I know I'm in the tattered cover tonight, and I'm delighted to be here. Denver and Colorado has always had fond associations for me. I first came here for any significant time in the summer of 1950, when I spent that summer as a graduate student at Northwestern University working on a doctoral dissertation on the Colorado coal strike of 1913 and 1914, which ended in the notorious Ludlow massacre. My dissertation director at Northwestern was directing his first doctoral dissertation. I was his guinea pig, and he later became the definitive biographer of Woodrow Wilson. His name was Arthur Link, and he wrote five or six volumes on Woodrow Wilson. He told me there was a gap in his research on an important industrial battle out here in the coal fields of southern Colorado, and he thought it would make an excellent dissertation topic because the Wilson administration that he was primarily interested in historically had intervened in that industrial strife and sent in the federal troops to finally restore order. In any event, one of the most enjoyable summers of my life was that 3.5 months here in Denver. I traded places with a teacher from Denver who loaned us his house that summer, and he lived in our house in Chicago where he was doing research at the Newberry Library. So I've had a fond attraction for this state ever since. There are other things that came to my mind today. This is the area where Gary Hart has come to fame and national attention. He was the campaign manager of the McGovern presidential campaign in 1972. I doubt seriously if I would have won that nomination in a field of 17 other Democratic contenders, some of them rather formidable people like Hubert Humphrey, Ed Muskie, Scoop Jackson, John Lindsay, and whole string Governor Sanford. So I have great feelings about Gary and his wife Lee and his family. And I think this is a pretty nifty place to be. I've written 11 books in my life, and I think I'm getting better because the books are getting shorter. You remember the old comment often quoted of the guy who said to a friend of his, "Dear Joe, I've been terribly busy. I'm sorry that I just don't have time to write you a short letter." So he wrote a long letter. And I've discovered that's easier to write a long book than it is to condense what you have to say on an important national issue in a few pages. But Fulcrum Press set that guideline for me, as they did for Gary Hart and Dick Lamb, who are also authors of excellent books in this Speaker's Corner series. My book, I think, is 76 pages, but it deals with one of the most important programs in the history of this country, Social Security. It's been serving the American people for 70 years, ever since 1935, when President Roosevelt decided in the depths of the Depression that this country desperately needed some kind of a financial undergirding for people when they reached age 65. Or if they were disabled before that, they would start collecting when they're disabled. If they were killed before they reached 65, their spouses and their children would draw benefits. For example, the 3,000 people who were killed on 9/11 in the World Trade Center, their survivors, their spouses, their children got the first Social Security check within 30 days. And they've been getting it ever since and will on into the future. It's probably the most efficient single part of the federal government. It returns 98 cents on every dollar that workers and their employers contribute, plus the interest on that money. It's invested in U.S. government bonds. So it's been a marvelous program. Roosevelt explained to his sidekick, Harry Hopkins, that he was for that program partly because he wanted to get Grandma out of the basement. And Hopkins said, "What do you mean by that?" He says, "Well, there are a lot of families during these Depression years who, after retirement, don't have any income to live on. And they haven't been able to save enough in these tough years to live, so they move in with their children or a relative. And usually they're put in the attic or in the basement or some other out-of-the-way place in the home. It creates a certain amount of tension in the family and a certain financial hardship on the young people who are still working." He says, "So I'd like to get Grandma out of the attic." And that was one of his motivations in supporting Social Security, and it has largely done that. So let me put it to you this way. If I had the capacity to put my name as the author on any legislation of the 20th century, I'd pick Social Security. That's how highly I regard this program. It's a marvelous program, and that's why it's so sad that for the first time we have a president going across this country telling people the program is going bankrupt, which of course it is not. As a matter of fact, Social Security is the most solvent part of the federal government. It's about the only part that doesn't borrow money every month. And the Defense Department, every other department of the government is borrowing money now. I don't know whether you're aware of this, but every day the United States government borrows $2 billion, which is added to the national debt. We used to say when I was growing up, well, don't worry about the national debt because we owe it to ourselves. That's not true anymore. We owe it to the Chinese. We owe it to the Japanese. We owe it to the Germans, all countries that we defeated in the Second World War, but which are now bailing us out every month in terms of these huge deficits that have accelerated enormously in the last 4 or 5 years, but not Social Security. Social Security has always paid its own way every month. They take out 6%, a little more than that, from your paycheck. The employer matches it, and the program has always been solvent, except in the first few years before they had a chance to build up the Social Security Trust Fund. The Congress had to provide some money to get it started because they immediately began getting beneficiaries, but they hadn't been contributing long enough to run up the Social Security Trust Fund. There was another time in 1983 during the Reagan administration when it looked like the Social Security Trust Fund, which has always run at a surplus, was getting down somewhat, and that maybe some correction was needed. So President Reagan asked Mr. Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and Bob Dole, a prominent Republican, longtime friend of mine, and a prominent Democrat, Pat Moynihan of New York, to chair a committee to correct this approaching, approaching lowering of the trust fund. And they recommended a modest change in the withholding tax. It didn't work a hardship on anybody. And the Social Security Trust Fund since then has been running at a surplus. Does anybody here know how much that surplus is now in the Social Security Trust Fund? Yeah, about $2 trillion. You show me another part of the government that's got $2 trillion. Dollars. Some of our great private corporations don't have those reserves. General Motors and Ford, two of the great companies in this country, have each just laid off 30,000 workers because they're running short on the operating funds to maintain that kind of a workforce. But so I can only conclude that the president and his advisors are not in favor of the Social Security Trust Fund, or they would not be trying to undercut it by predicting its demise, its bankruptcy. They are advocating, or were for the last year since the 2004 election. As you know, the president's gone out across the country, and I don't have any malice towards President Bush. I want every president to be a great success. I happen to be a personal friend of his father, so it's not with any particular delight that I take issue with an incumbent administration, but they're just wrong on this point, and I think it's because deep down they don't believe in the federal government providing security for Americans in their old age or when they're disabled or when they leave dependent survivors. And they know that they can't make a frontal attack on Social Security. Some of you may remember that President Reagan, when he first came into the White House, sent up a bill to curtail Social Security, to cut back on the benefits. And he was urging then what our current president now urges, which is that we put the money into private accounts instead of into the Social Security Trust Fund. He sent that bill up to the Senate, and I know this, I remember it vividly. It was defeated in the Senate 98-0. Even Jesse Helms voted no. Well, President Reagan may have been a conservative, but he was also a pragmatist, and he never again said a word of criticism of the Social Security system. President Bush, for all of his merit, is not a pragmatist. He's more of an ideologue. And I think he's convinced that Social Security is big government encroaching on our lives. And why not turn that $2 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund over to the federal government and let people put their money into the stock market or into Las Vegas or some other venture, and they'll earn more dividends. Well, Social Security was never intended to be an investment. It's more like fire insurance on your house or automobile insurance. I don't think you collect dividends on your automobile insurance. You, matter of fact, pay out these payments to keep that policy in force. But if somebody smashes your car, or if you smash it, then it pays off. And so most of us think that while we don't earn any money on these policies, it's a good thing to have. And that's what Social Security is. It's an insurance policy underwritten by the credit of the United States government. As they collect money, they put it into U.S. government bonds, which don't pay, the president's right, they don't pay big dividends, but the money is there when you need it. Some people have made a lot of money in the stock market. Regrettably, I'm not one of them, but it's a gamble for most people. I would much rather my survivors, my children and my wife, if they outlive me, I would much rather that they be protected by the credit of the United States government and the Social Security Trust Fund. So when the president started on this campaign against Social Security, after this last election, I decided to write this little book. I added it to an already busy schedule. I begin by saying I wrote this book partly because I'm a young guy, only 83 years old, and I don't agree with these editorial writers and syndicated columnists who've been telling us in recent years that it's a calamity that Americans are living longer. I think it's wonderful. And I believe with Thomas Jefferson that life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are three of the great goals. And I especially like that life part, although I don't think I'd want to live in a country that didn't have liberty. But somehow the notion has spread across this country, I think encouraged by people that have never really accepted the idea of Social Security, that it's a bad idea, and that they particularly work on young people. They say, look at all these baby boomers. Look at how many of them are going to be into the beneficiary level. How are we ever going to finance all this? And the president and those who think as he does on this issue have been telling audiences, you young people out there, by the time you reach 65, there'll be no money in the trust fund. That's a falsehood. There is no way that the Congress of the United States will ever permit you to miss one Social Security check for the simple reason that they're not eager to commit political suicide. And so, if necessary, we could finance this program on any shortfall by direct appropriations from the Treasury, the same way we do all the rest of the government. But that's not going to be necessary. A few modest steps that we ought to have the common sense to figure out, as we did in 1983, will safeguard this future for further into the future than any of us can now see. Will Rogers once said, it ain't what people don't know that's dangerous, it's what they know that just ain't so. And you think about that. The administration knew that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction targeted on the United States. He was never asked to explain why, if Iraq had any such weapons, they would target them on the United States. They're far more likely, if they had any, to target them on Iran, their next-door neighbor, with which they fought a bloody war in the 1980s. And some of you will remember, we backed Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis during that 10 years war because we thought Iran was a greater threat to the security of the Persian Gulf and the oil fields than Iraq. But be that as it may, Iraq had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. We know that. The president knows it. The vice president knows it. Everybody that has read the reports know that that was done by the Al-Qaeda network under the direction of Osama bin Laden, who was a Saudi Arabian, not an Iraqi. In fact, the 19 young men that he recruited to carry out that 9/11 attack, 15 of them were Saudi Arabians, and four of them from Egypt. And they signed on with Osama bin Laden out there in the desert, and that little band, equipped only with box cutters, hijacked four airplanes and smashed the World Trade Center and part of the Pentagon. But the president knew, or so he told Congress, that Saddam Hussein in Iraq was involved heavily in the 9/11 attacks, and that furthermore he had possibly nuclear weapons, biological or chemical weapons. The international arms experts of the United Nations couldn't find any such weapons, even though they were in there for years. Neither could our army, probably the best army we've ever sent abroad, been able to find any such weapons. So 2,500 wonderful young Americans have died floundering around in that desert, supposedly to eliminate these weapons of mass destruction that weren't there, and now we see this insurgency raging as it did in Vietnam all those years. Occupying armies are not all that popular, even good armies like we think ours is. Those of you that know a little American history know that that's one reason we fought the American Revolution, was to throw the British troops out of the colonies where they were not welcome. So it's easy for leaders to tell us things they know that just aren't true. That was true in Vietnam. It's true in Iraq. It's true with Social Security. My first recommendation on Social Security is to leave it alone. There are far more serious problems in the government than the financing of Social Security. I outline in this little book of mine a few steps that I think would eliminate any risk at all in the future of Social Security financing. Even if we did nothing, there wouldn't be any problem for perhaps another 40 years. But we can do something. We can take certain modest steps, and this will be, as it has always been, the most dependable part of the United States government. So that's the purpose of this book, to try to answer error mistaken thinking with what I believe is common sense. But I'd like to stop at this point, if I may, and
thank you so much for coming out this evening. Thank you for supporting independent bookstores and for supporting our events. Tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce author and former Colorado Governor Richard Lamb, who will talk about his new book, Two Wands, One Nation, an essay on race and community in America. This book is part of Fulcrum Publishing's Speaker's Corner Books, which is a series designed to stimulate, educate, and foster discussion on public policy topics. Richard Lamb is a co-director of the Institute for Public Policy Studies at the University of Denver and a former three-term governor of Colorado. He is a nationally recognized expert on healthcare issues and is the author of numerous articles on healthcare that have appeared in a variety of medical publications. He also wrote the book, which we have copies of in back, of Brave New World of Healthcare. As if that weren't enough, he's also a lawyer and worked for several years as a civil rights attorney with the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Association and a certified public accountant. So please welcome Richard Lamb.
Hey, thank you. Thank you all for coming. I'm very appreciative, and even though I do a lot of speaking, obviously, but any governor does, but I'm strangely nervous tonight because I am taking on a subject that, as we all know, comes as close to being the third rail, I guess, is what I'm saying, as you can approach. Let me give you my metaphor. My metaphor is that I have two wands. In this wand, I can wave over the white America and completely eliminate all racism and discrimination. And with this wand in my left hand, I can wave over the ghettos and barrios of America, and I can give them Japanese or Jewish love of learning, of values and attitudes toward education. But I can only wave one wand. Which do you want me to wave? Well, obviously, I go on to say that the answer to me, anyway, is clear. You would wish to wave both wands, obviously. Nobody can not want to eliminate any vestige of racism and discrimination, and it's more than a vestige. But the point that I'm trying to make, that it would be better, in fact, if you had to choose the second wand. I go on to really point out that the highest family income in America are all minorities that have been discriminated against. That doesn't justify the discrimination, but it's interesting that Japanese Americans, Jews, Chinese Americans, and Korean Americans are the highest family income in America, which to me shows that that it is possible that racism and discrimination, never justified, but is a barrier, a hurdle rather than a barrier. So let me say again what I'm saying and what I'm not saying. I'm certainly not saying that it's time to stop fighting racism and discrimination. It seems to me that's going to be with us all the rest of my lifetime, and probably my children's also. But I would suggest we have to add to that a new emphasis on self-reliance and self-responsibility. It's very interesting to me that black and Hispanic students do half as much homework as Asian and Jewish students, and, not surprisingly, they get half as good grades. Those are things that are within the ability of the minority community itself to deal with. So what I'm looking at is we have a terrible problem of underperformance in America. Underperformance, frankly, I think, of all of our children, but specifically in our minority community, or more specifically in our black and Hispanic community. I think it's rising to a level that it needs more honest discussion than we've given it to date. I ran into this by the political correctness of higher education, where my two wands metaphor could not even be published. Well, that got my interest in saying that there should be nothing that should be beyond conversation. So not alone in this, obviously. It's been said by Bill Cosby, Shelby Steele, John McWhorter. There's a wonderful Hispanic author, Lionel Sousa, who wrote a book called The Americano Dream, where his first chapter in that book was Escaping the Cultural Shackles. Bernard Lewis, the famous Princeton historian, makes a very interesting point when he says, speaking of the Middle East, but it applies, I think, more broadly, he says, when things go wrong in people's lives, there's two big questions that they ask. The first question is, who's doing it to me? And the second question is, what am I doing wrong? And he went to point out that when you ask the second question, it starts you on a road to improvement and self-responsibility. So in my travels, Dottie and I, I've always been intrigued about the difference between North America and South America, both of them very rich continents. And yet North America somehow exploded in success, where South America, with in many ways equal amount of natural resources, is caught in a cycle of poverty that nobody seems to be able to interrupt. I'm intrigued by the difference between Ghana and South Korea, both of which in 1950 had the same per capita income, but South Korea exploded with success, and Ghana is also mired in poverty. The difference between Argentina and Australia. In 1900, again, they had the same per capita income. What explains when one succeeds and the other, if not fails, at least doesn't begin to achieve the promise that their natural resources would seem to promise them? So the more that I look at this, the more I'm intrigued by the role of culture in the success of various groups of people. By culture, I mean their values, their attitudes, the behavior traits that they bring to of ambition and reading or whatever else it is that they bring to a given problem. That colonialism, it's interesting to me in Africa to see the new dialogue going on among a certain amount of African leaders saying, hey, wait a minute, we've been colonialized, but so also have the fastest growing economies in the world been colonized. In other words, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, they were colonized by the Japanese, and if you have a choice between being colonized by the British and colonized by the Japanese back in the 30s, folks, it's no close question. So why is it then that certain societies and certain people succeed? It goes beyond certain countries. It goes the overseas Chinese seemed to be successful almost wherever they go. So obviously that colonialism is a problem, but it isn't a totally innervating problem. It's a problem that other places have overcome with the right combination of factors. So when you look at these combination of factors, i.e. the colonialism as a hurdle but not a barrier, racism and discrimination as a hurdle but not a barrier, doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to reduce those hurdles. But in fact, it's not any longer a total answer to the question of minority underperformance. Daniel Patrick Moynihan said a very fascinating thing about 10 years ago. He said that the central conservative truth, he said, is that it is culture, not politics, that determines the success of a society. And he went on to say, and the central liberal truth, he said, is that politics can change a culture and save it from itself. So that's really what I'm writing about. That how there are different cultural traits that have to be looked at and have to expand the conversation about minority performance beyond just racism and discrimination. I have a chapter in this book called Are Mexicans Italians? Let me explain that. Well, obviously the Italians were the last group to come to America, and people said, oh, they're not going to succeed. They're always going to be caught in the lower economic rungs of our society. And for a while it looked that would be the case. On top of it, they had a high crime rate and their connection with the mafia. But now the average Italian-American has a family income higher than the average American income, which actually shows that that different people have come to America and have been sort of suffered the under expectations have succeeded brilliantly. So that's my story. I can go on, but I think I know that done enough of this to know that there'll be lots of questions over there, so I'd like to just stop there.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Adrian McKinty, Joanne Greenberg, Allegra Goodman, John Grogan, Rita Mae Brown, Francis Mays, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded in February 2006.